Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. Today, we're going to talk about the medical catastrophe inside Gaza and how doctors and health experts are trying to address the enormous needs of their community. We're joined today by Dr. Majid Jaber. Majid has been working in the European hospital until Israel ordered the hospital to evacuate in early July. He's also worked at the Al Emirati Hospital before the Rafah invasion in May. Dr. Majid, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Yeah, thank you for letting me have the space to share my opinions as a doctor in Gaza. You know, the media tries to censor as much coverage as possible due to different agenda. I'm not going to get into to save the time. So yeah, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for being here. Give us a sense of the kind of medicine you practice and where you are currently able to work.
Okay, so I was trying to match into internal medicine, which is for people who don't know anything about medicine. It's like when you go to a doctor due to heart disease, kidney disease, neurological, it's just like, see, general medicine, but it's really fun. And I was trying to, even before the war, I was accepted in Manchester University to pursue a master's degree in immunology, but the war broke out, I couldn't travel, so I was stuck here. And I didn't have much plans to stay in Gaza because I wanted to further my medical knowledge and education, which is sadly far more superior in the West than here in the Middle East due to everything. So when the war broke out, my first decision was to get more into emergency medicine. I'm not in the emergency medicine board, but I was technically an emergency doctor working most of the time because this is where doctors are needed most during the war. Emergency sounds convenient. A lot of injuries, a lot of dead people, a lot of people who are not injured directly from the airstrike, but they're having a heart attack from stress or emotional stress that causes a lot of that precipitates heart attacks or even strokes. And people are neglected, etc., etc. It's a very messy, chaotic place. It was already chaotic before the war, just because of the poor structure of the Ministry of Health, because of the poor coordination of the hospitals. And now with the war breaking out, it makes everything clear as day that we had issues and now we're suffering the consequences. Now, those issues might not be solely, let's say, on the occupation. It's also, we have a lot of issues, internal issues when it comes to coordination and bad selection of leaders. This is another wild topic, but we're now put into we're now facing reality, which is everything sucks and we have to deal with it and we have to save lives, and we barely have any facilities at the start of the war, and as the war progressed we kept having less and less facilities and equipment. We kept having a lot of doctors being either killed, especially highly specialized doctors, doctors who are deciding to leave Gaza due to their injuries, due to their, well, they're trying to save their own lives. And now we're having barely any specialized doctors, barely have any really good surgeons, specialized surgeons. We have a lot of departments that closed due to either the forced evacuation of hospitals, the destruction of hospitals. We don't have an ophthalmology operating theater. We don't have eye surgeries anymore. I know few doctors, few eye surgeons that wanted to come here to Gaza, but the COGAT refused their entry because, well, there's no eye surgeries possible here in Gaza, so why are you coming here? And they were like, okay, we can do the bare minimum, we can just do whatever. And they're just like, no, get out.
COGAT, of course, is the bureaucratic arm of Israel's occupation military.
Very nasty. They're just preventing anyone with a smell of Palestinian background to enter Gaza for no reason at all.
Tell us what's it like? I mean, you've worked at least two hospitals in Gaza that have been forcibly evacuated by Israel. What is it like evacuating an entire hospital with patients with very delicate injuries, with hospital staff, with patients' families, with internally displaced people, with equipment? What is it like having to evacuate this
So
kind of place?
the first hospital, the first evacuation experience I had was in the Emirati Hospital, which is a hospital that was dedicated for gynecology obstetrics, which is basically women medicine, pregnant women with any disease related to reproductive issues, etc. And they also reopened before the war a NICU department, neonatal ICU for recently born newborns. So it makes sense, of course. You're delivering a baby now, I want to take care of the baby. So they tried to do that. But it was bad before the war, and it was bad during the war until the UNICEF stepped up and provided us with some incubators, some ventilators, and everything was working well. It was bad, but now, but then it became less bad because we had some facilities and we had a lot of doctors from all over the Gaza Strip coming here, trying to help, volunteering, completely volunteering. And what we need to keep in mind is the standard of care here in Gaza specifically is nowhere near what you would assume in the West. In the West, if there's a child that coughs, the whole hospital they gather their focus, just like, let's solve this issue, let's order a million tests to figure out what's wrong with the baby. We don't have that. We don't have the lab tests, we don't have the imaging. We don't have the capabilities, and sometimes we don't have the electricity to do so. And so, what happens is that we start to treat patients empirically, which is we try to follow the guidelines as much as possible. And we're very knowledgeable. Everyone, most of us here, well, use the same medical sources that other doctors use, but the other doctors have the advantage of having more advanced equipment, more complex.
Electricity,
Yeah, like electricity. Yeah, right. Thank you. They have blood pressure monitors for God's sake. And so those babies, you can delve into many stories regarding those newborns. Let's focus at the neonatal ICU. So a lot of these babies that were in Rafah came from Gaza during the destruction of most of the central pediatric hospitals in Gaza Strip, which is the Nasser Hospital, not Nasser in Khan Yunis, Nasser Hospital, Atlantisa Hospital. We're talking about Kamal Adwan. We're talking about these big medical complexes with a special dedication towards pediatrics. So what we also need to know is that these hospitals were the main hospital that every child in Gaza goes to. Children with a lot of rare genetic diseases, heart disease, kidney diseases, and neurological diseases, etc., etc. Even they can even be kids with cancer. They had to go to these hospitals. There's no cancer center in the south. There is no big cardiological facility. There's no nephro department, etc. So all of these had to rely to go to Gaza. And even if they go to Gaza, children with cystic fibrosis, children with cancer, patients with familial Mediterranean fever, patients with heart disease, they needed specific equipment. They needed specific physiotherapy. They needed medications that are not allowed to come here into Gaza, and they had to go to the occupied land, namely Israel. They had to go to Egypt. They had to go to Jordan to receive that treatment and then come back. And then they do this on weekly or monthly basis, and they were relying into it. And when the war broke out, this was done.
Yeah.
They can't go anywhere. What we also need to know is in Gaza, there's a lot of places with high rates of consanguinity, intermarriage. So this makes newborns and children very prone to rare genetic illnesses, rare metabolic diseases. So much so, a lot of doctors around the world come to Gaza to study these diseases because you never see these in the West. You only read about them. And then you come here and be like, oh my gosh, we're discovering new syndromes here in Gaza, sadly. And now all these kids that could have survived by receiving that medication from the occupied territories, from Egypt, etc., they're not allowed, they're prevented that opportunity. And what we witnessed at the start of the war at the European Gaza Hospital, which has the biggest pediatric department in the south, albeit not specialized, that those kids keep dying.
Yeah.
So you can't do anything about it because they lack that certain enzyme. They lack that certain type of medication and just can't provide this anymore. So, yeah.
And that's part of the, you know, the Lancet, the British medical journal that just came out with their estimate that 186,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed either directly or indirectly by this war, by this genocide. That's part of those statistics, is not the the direct, you know, bombing of someone's house, or, you know, the use of tank shells, but these indirect kind of, you know, successive impact of this genocide of children with very, you know, delicate medical needs, not being able to get the treatment that they would otherwise be entitled to anywhere else in the world, because of Israel's sadistic blockade, not just over the last 9 months of medicine and food and, you know, basic nutritional supplies of fuel for, you know, for electricity generators, but also over the last 17 years of the siege on Gaza, where hospitals before this war were already at a tipping point. It's a struggle to try and comprehend what Israel has done to the medical sector in Gaza. What was it like before October, in terms of the level of medicine that you were able, you know, that doctors in Gaza were able to work with, antibiotics, chemotherapy, you know, people who needed dialysis. What was it like before October compared to what it's like now?
Well, it was better, that's for sure, but not good. We're not self-reliant or self-independent when it comes to medical healthcare. So even we have to keep in mind that the Israelis always kept what kind of medications that enter Gaza, what kind of equipment that enter Gaza in check, because they don't want us to rely on ourselves. They do not want that sense of autonomy here, even in medical aspects. And this is designed specifically to discourage every healthcare worker here, every doctor with ambitions, every doctor that wants to specialize. Let's say I personally went to a European country, went to America to finish my medical education, sub-specialize in some really good, effective specialty that has an impact to our society here in Gaza. I wouldn't be able to do anything in Gaza. And that's frustrating. Let's say I'm not able to get the specific tools that I need to use, the specific medications. It's just like, I have all the knowledge again, but I can't do anything about it. You feel completely paralyzed. And so, yeah, when it comes to dialysis, There was in the south, Nasser Hospital. We had in the north, the Achi Hospital, the big nephro department. But we also have 2.2 million people, a lot of elderly, a lot of diabetic people, a lot of people who have bad habits, drugs, smoking, etc. They develop a lot of chronic illnesses, specifically renal diseases, and then now we have to deal with a huge number of patients, but you barely have enough dialysis machines. And if you're gonna talk to any nephrologist, he's gonna whine and rant for hours about how there are infections, repetitive infections due to the filtering system being dysfunctional at times. There is no clear water. People keep dying from infections because when you insert the dialysis machine, you have to insert the catheter into your arm. And if you insert it into your arm, if the environment is not sterile, you're going to induce more infections. And this is how my uncle kind of died also because of septic emboli. And yeah, you just keep losing people because of what can we do about this? And
Sorry
this,
about your uncle. That's horrible.
all good. So yeah, eventually people start feeling burned out and very frustrated with the whole system. And this further lowers the standard of care even more and more because if you don't have hope, if you can't find light at the end of the tunnel, people start not really functioning the way they should function. And this is also something that they design specifically, despair, frustration, on and on. The drones are designed to have really loud, annoying sounds, not because the motors need to produce that sound, but just to piss us off, to make us anxious most of the time. So much so, it feels normal right now because the drone went away. I was like, yeah, something feels off. Oh, there's no drone noise for 5 minutes. Oh, that's peaceful. Yeah.
It's unbearable. Give us a sense of the types of epidemics that are running rampant across Gaza because of the lack of access to clean water. Israel has destroyed, so much everything in Gaza, but the infrastructure especially has led to outbreaks of hepatitis A. The Ministry of Health in Gaza just announced on Thursday that the virus that causes polio has been detected in pools of sewage around Gaza. Parents are talking about their babies, their toddlers, young children having really painful rashes, skin infections. And no way to mitigate it. There, with medicine or, it just seems impossible. What kinds of infectious diseases are you and your colleagues seeing around Gaza, and how are you able to mitigate it?
Okay, so let's start with hepatitis. Of course, when you airstrike and bombard and flatten out cities, the infrastructure is gone, and a lot of sewage is going to spread everywhere. There are a lot of places everywhere with very nasty smell, mosquitoes, flies that keep on spreading diseases that I'll talk about. First of which, let's talk about hepatitis. So when the Israelis are anyway, just preventing you from even getting soap or getting shampoos or getting alcohol gels, getting your toilet paper, hygiene levels are gonna drop down because people want to clean themselves, but It's either hella expensive when you're talking about a toilet wrap. It's like $5, and you have a lot of families. And it's like, how the hell am I gonna afford that? Food, what we call it, foodborne indices, diseases that spread via, we call it a fecal oral route. So, someone who gets out of the bathroom, not cleaning himself very properly due to lack of every hygiene tool in mind. They start eating, someone else eats, and then that spreads a disease. So we have a lot of long list of foodborne indices. We're gonna talk about hepatitis A for now. Hepatitis A has been spreading since November. So I also have worked in a lot of shelter schools. So we ha I had to deal with like thousands and thousands of patients. And the number one disease that I had to deal with is hepatitis A. Some with abdominal pain, some vomiting, some with a yellowish discoloration, what we call jaundice. People get very sick, very tired, and it is self-limiting. But when you realize the infective period is almost a month, you realize that the whole school is going to be infected soon because there's no way you can detect the disease before it spreads. And in very crowded places, very unhygienic places, you're going to have that kind of issue. So it is self-limiting, but sadly, there are very rare occasions where the disease relapses, where the disease progresses into acute liver failure. Progresses into very fatal complications, cause other syndromes. And because you have 2 million people, mostly like 90% have hepatitis A, this rare complication turns into a huge chunk. We have a lot of patients who come here with hepatitis A, but look very ill, progressive to liver failure, and we lost a lot of patients due to liver failure. We lost a lot of patients due to very. We have witnessed some complications of hepatitis A that I really cannot explain.
Such as what?
I have no idea. We had this patient with a very weird rash with that was fine, but then suddenly relapsed into. He had this very ugly rash. He had this very severe jaundice, and we lost him in the span of 2 days, and we still don't know what happened exactly. Some doctors are trying to explain it was vasculitis, it was something else, but we just couldn't figure out why. We didn't even have the time to do so, and he wasn't responding to anything. We had a lot of kids, a lot of daughters, a lot of girls, a lot of young kids, a lot of children dying from hepatitis A, sadly, and those people need liver transplant, which is not gonna happen. Even if you, in some miracle, were allowed permission to leave Gaza, it's gonna probably be too late. And so on and so on. Even the drugs that slow the progression of liver failure, lactulose, rifaximin, etc., are just not available anymore. So you really can't do much about it. So a disease that is self-limiting and simple as hepatitis A became a nightmare for the people of Gaza. You also have to keep in mind that most of people here, of course, we lost our livelihoods, but a lot are still wanting to work. They try to find something to gain money from in daily basis, and when you get sick for a month, you're destroying a family's source of income. So keep that also in mind. Other indices that we're hearing about is cholera. Even the UN for a period of time was warning about cholera, and because we had this patient who has very severe diarrhea, no fever, no abdominal pain, just severe diarrhea. It was scary. And this patient died before even coming to the hospital. And we have another, it is anecdotal total for me, but it's a doctor I trust. Same kind of story, but he kind of came to the hospital. He was severely depleted from electrolytes and everything. He went into arrhythmia and cardiac arrest, and they couldn't save him. So it is possible, but I can't really confirm that it was cholera, sadly. But even though the symptoms fit. Also, let's talk about other diseases. Of course, malaria is a big topic, is a very hot topic because of the sewage, because of the very polluted ponds everywhere. And we're really close to Egypt, really close to... we're in the Middle East where malaria is heavily prevalent. Of course, we don't have malaria here in Gaza, but it might develop, it might spread at some point, which is very likely. Hopefully not. The stories about polio is really scary, because once you get infected with polio, you're going to have a paralyzed person for life. Yeah, I haven't dealt with it personally. I hope I never deal with this, and I hope that no child suffer from polio. It's an old disease, something we are happy that we moved on due to vaccination, and you never know or hear about polio in the West unless it's a very rural, disconnected area. So, yeah. I'm trying to think of a lot of outbreaks here.
Yeah, I mean, it just must be overwhelming.
It is. So, yeah, a final note. Of course, we have a lot of things to talk about, but right now I want to keep a final note that a lot of doctors who are specialized in infection control, a lot of doctors who are very, they're well-versed in medicine, they're consultants, they're big doctors, I just keep opening the discussion about there must be some new organisms and new organisms in Gaza that are undetected. We are not able to identify those organisms due to, well, we don't have the time, we don't have the facilities, and those organisms keep killing people. And, well, a lot of illnesses cause the area and abdominal pain, but not to that extent. It's very scary. And I'll talk about the lack of vaccination and the, also antibiotic resistances. Right. We have a lot of patients who have multi-drug resistance. The organisms cannot respond to anything. Let's say only colistin. And if you have a brain infection like meningitis, encephalomyelitis, which you need a drug that reaches the brain, passes the blood-brain barrier, good luck, colistin doesn't do that. So the patient dies. And there are outbreaks in the, well, supposed to be the most sterile environments in the hospital, the ICU and the operating theaters. We have outbreaks of Klebsiella. We have outbreaks of Actinobacter. And those organisms keep killing patients. Even if the patient survives, let's say, a very fatal trauma, he goes to the operating theater, he survives, he does well, then he gets infected in the post-op room, in the ICU, and then he dies. And this sadly became a very dark humor, like, don't get close to the ICU, you're gonna die. Some surgeons just sometimes joke desperately with each other, like, yeah, we're gonna do our best, but yeah, it's gonna go to the ICU. Yeah.
I mean, it's just impossible to begin to understand. And then on top of all of this, of course, you have Israeli airstrikes. You have the series of massacres that we saw just in the last 10 days or so, where there are, you know, 5-6 massacres a day.
In Al-Mawasi, of all places.
In the so-called safe zones.
And my family lives there. And, you know, I'm just like, my brain cannot process it, because we were displaced multiple times, and we thought, okay, this is Al-Mawasi. It's a very distant, disconnected place with no infrastructure. We are struggling to get water. We are struggling to get Food, we are struggling to get anything, we are struggling to charge our phones, to call anyone. And we were like, okay, but at least we're safe. And we're not anymore. They keep killing people in highly crowded places, really crowded places next to water desalination centers, next to markets, etc. And what's going on exactly? Where are we supposed to go? Everywhere there's a massacre there, where, everywhere there's a tragedy, and these people don't care.
And the kinds of weapons that the Israelis are using, of course, 500-pound bombs, 2,000-pound bombs delivered on a silver platter by the Biden administration. You have reports of white phosphorus, fire belts, these bunker buster bombs that are being used against tents, people in tents on the sand dunes in Al Mawasi. What happens inside a barely functioning hospital like Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, where people are brought after the kinds of massacres that we've seen in Al Mawasi in the last couple of weeks?
You have to keep in mind that Nasser Hospital was recently reopened, and this hospital barely has the facilities it used to have, which was barely enough. And there are a lot of doctors that are still struggling to work, even when there are no massacres, because we don't have anything. And when these massacres happened, happened to those doctors, happens to the hospital, was shock. We can't do anything. Okay, I have 20 doctors, but there are not enough beds, there's no enough ambu bags, there are not enough drugs, there are not enough basic stuff. So at the European Gaza Hospital, when I was working as an emergency doctor, we didn't even have properly functioning blood pressure monitors. I'm trying to resuscitate a patient, I can't get a decent read. I want to know where this is going. I can't properly plug the cardiac monitors because they take forever to have a decent read. We're trying to the pulse oximeters, these things are called the vital signs for a reason, which is they are related to, well, is this dead, dying, or gonna live? When you don't even have those, you're just lost for words. You start to act instinctively. Sometimes that works, but most of them that doesn't. That if I'm gonna describe what happens to these hospitals during a massacre, is shock, is the realization that we can't do much. Even if the patient reaches a hospital.
I mean, how does that impact you as a physician, as a healer, as someone who's spent, probably most of your young adult life, learning how to care for people, in very scientific but also intuitive ways? How are you as a healer, as a health worker, as a physician, able to just able to treat people when you know that you are only there to accompany them into what is most likely a very painful, and very premature, death? I mean, what does that do to physicians?
So, well, you have to also keep in mind that we have been living in Gaza for all of our lives. This is not the first massacre. This is not the first tragedy. When we were kids, we've witnessed people getting killed, people getting split into a million pieces. It's not new to us. So there's some kind of a calm demeanor to all of us that is not right, but is also a reaction, a coping mechanism to what's going on. But we also have to do our best. Even if I'm looking to a patient and we know that he's gonna die, gonna arrest, and we don't have any way to save him. We have to do our best. Sometimes it's not ethically right to not do anything. If you have a kid who is dying in front of you have to do everything. You have to push fluids, you have to try to repair to figure out where the bleed is, you have to intubate him, you have to work really hard to not only for the baby himself, but for the grieving family next to you, because this kid, yeah, is gonna die, but I want them to know that we did our best. And who knows, maybe the baby survives, right? Like this 1%, this 1 of 1,000 probability that this kid might survive is still there, the light at the end of the tunnel, you know. And of course, it develops a seeing thousands of injuries during this short period develops an intuition as to how to deal with patients. It's a very painful experience that most doctors can't comprehend. We have a lot of foreign doctors, a lot of emergency doctors coming here from all over the world, and they sometimes get paralyzed and they just cannot really process how we function, especially when we don't have the facilities, we don't have the big teams, we don't have the big equipment, we don't have Superman around us. And they just look at very young doctors like me, and they just see me like doing everything from A to Z, when normally every doctor should handle a letter. And I'm just doing all the alphabet. It's like, what is this? This is crazy. The amount of stress is incomprehensible, yet it feels very normal to us. But should tell everyone about the amount of stress about the traumas we've been through all of our lives to make us reach that point. And most of these doctors that you see on social media, all these doctors you see on reports and interviews, most of them are really young doctors. We've witnessed people getting killed. We've witnessed people, family members, we've witnessed friends, we've witnessed a lot of people getting killed when we're younger, and now we're adults. Doctors can make a change, can do something, and we have to do something, because if you don't do something, you can't really forgive yourself. And this keeps pushing you further and further. And it sucks, really, when there's a massacre where 30 people are killed. When you have, let's say, 30 families killed, and you just breaking bad news is a very tough situation. And even the families are starting to get used to breaking bad news. You have a friend or someone or yourself that I personally lost uncles, I personally lost cousins, I personally lost a lot of dear people to me. And if someone like me still grieve, still cries, still. What do you expect of other people? And we ha I have this mother that lost her older son in an airstrike, and she was weeping and weeping and crying. And she was begging me, please do something about it. And she's like, I'm sorry. Can't do anything about it. The son came to the hospital with his brain out, and that's it. And to see the despair on the in her eyes is very rough. It's like imagining your mother weeping, imagining someone you know dying that way. And then a week later, the same woman comes to the hospital, but now her youngest son is dead. But she's not weeping anymore. She's very traumatized. She can't just cry or beg or anything. She just looks at the young kid and it's like, I can't really express what she's being through. Just she lost everything. And not even crying is gonna solve that. And you can measure. You can hear a lot of really heartbreaking stories. You have a kid that lost all his family. You have a family that lost a kid. And you have half and half. And you have it never ends, really.
Yeah, it's bottomless. Yeah, it's bottomless. Well, finally, what is your message to physicians, to health workers around the world who, I just keep thinking about, the American Medical Association or the Canadian Medical Association. These, very large, influential groups, institutions for, kind of these pinnacles of institutions for medicine around the world. And they have been absolutely silent about, not just the genocide in Gaza, but about what's happening to their colleagues, you and your colleagues, who are doing their best under the most unbearable circumstances in Gaza, trying to treat patients with no supplies, with no electricity, with no antibiotics, and still getting up every day and going to work and doing the job that you committed to do for your people. What can you say to other physicians? What do you think is most important for them to know about the work that you and your colleagues in Gaza are doing?
Silence is not neutral. Silence is complicity. And they're really complicit in the genocide as much as the ones who are actively doing it. When these associations fire physicians who come here to Gaza and get stuck for more than 2 weeks or 4 weeks, those people are complicit. They're trying to alienate people from coming here to Gaza because, hey, you might lose your job. And this is not silence. Also, this is active bullying and harassment. This is active pushing people away from helping us even a little bit. So I don't have much words to these associations. These associations are bought by bigger companies, we all know, and they're all funded and pushed by the same agenda. They are told from day one that you're not allowed to interfere in that kind of issue, and you don't have a say anyway. Because if you even entertain the idea of speaking up, you're done. And we all know that. We all know the lobbies, we all know. Yeah, let's just not get into it for now, at least. And so, yeah, I don't have any respect, of course, for those people. And it's just mind-boggling to be afraid to even stand with people who are getting killed every day. You don't have to stand. Just stand with the doctors at least. Have a word. Mention us. You can't even do that. It's just fascinating to me.
It's despicable. It's
It is.
despicable. Well, Majid, is there anything else that you wanted to let our audience know about the heroic work of doctors in Gaza What do you hope people take away from this conversation and from what you've been experiencing the last 9 months?
So it feels like most of our healthcare workers, at least the ones staying here, are doing it because of some kind of obligation towards their own people. I personally didn't have that, let's say, feeling of staying here until all of this ends. I had opportunities to leave, but I refused because I can't just leave my people behind. And even if I travel abroad, I would keep thinking about it, stressing about it. I could have done something, I could do something, and I'm able to do something. Even after the evacuation of the European Gaza Hospital, I'm still working. Of course, volunteering for free, unpaid, it became a side hobby, something to, you know, waste your time with. But people in camps do not have access to healthcare. You have these huge field hospitals. They pay millions and millions. And I don't know where the money goes exactly, because these people are not receiving healthcare. These people are not receiving treatments. And they're just like treating basic infections. They're treating, you know, common cold and diarrhea. But when it comes to actual problems, chronic illnesses, we're talking about operations. We're talking about, you know, like delivering babies, following up with pregnant women. Just, you know, use your leverage to escort these poor babies with genetic illnesses, with deformities, children that are amputated. You can't do this. You're just paralyzed. You're unable to. So what are you doing here exactly? Why is there a local young doctor who has nothing, an individual who has barely anything to wear, who lost everything, including a house and probably prospects to work here, doing more than you as an organization? We have large camps in Almawasi that need medical points, that need tents, they need ambulances in cases of emergency, and I'm just around there. They know there's a doctor by word. I go there, I check on them, they start relying on me, but I can't really handle 1,000 patients on my own. There has to be a bigger organization. And there are a lot of doctors who are doing the same like me. You know, we are trying to do our best in very harsh situations that no one, including me, would have imagined that this would happen and reach that point. Meanwhile, as we said, these associations, multimillionaires, multibillionaires, they sit on their couch, they're explicit in genocide, and they never faced these things. If they ever come here and just sit for a month and try to work under our conditions, they will be more respectful at least. But they're not. It's tough, but we're doing it. And we're not leaving until it ends. And we're going to keep doing our best, even with our minimal resources. Because if we're not doing it, who's going to do it? Yeah.
Dr. Majid Jabbar, you are a physician working in Gaza under the most unbelievable circumstances. I'm so glad that we had this time to talk today. I would love for you to come back on the Electronic Intifada podcast, and we'll be checking in with you very regularly. Thank you so much, Dr. Majid.
Thank you so much. It's my honor to join people, you folks, and the Electronic Intifada. I appreciate your work dearly. And yeah, I hope also to have a talk with you soon.
Yeah. And coffee on the beach in Gaza soon.
Yeah, sure. That would be lovely.
Thanks, Majid.
Thanks for watching this video. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Hit like, leave a comment. These engagements help us with the YouTube algorithm and it helps us to get around Silicon Valley censorship as much as possible. It does make a difference. You can also support our journalism by going to electronicintifada.net and clicking on Donate Now. Thank you.